Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Jessica Levinson, who teaches at Loyola Law School and was formerly the Director of Political Reform at the Center for Governmental Studies. Her work focuses on election law and governance issues, including campaign finance, ethics, and state budgets. She wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in McCormish versus Bennett, the case in which John Roberts and four other justices ruled to prohibit public election funding to match excessive spending by wealthy interests. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jessica Levinson.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this ruling today for McCormish versus Bennett, it actually was, I think, the full title of the group said more about them, what their political action committee, what was it called? It was called Arizona's Free Enterprise Club's Freedom Club PAC. So the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the powerful over the powerless.
Well, what the Supreme Court did is, you're right, it made it harder for the average citizen, the non-moneyed citizen, to participate in politics. And this is a number of series of decisions, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, where the Supreme Court has chipped away at common sense campaign finance reforms. In this case in particular, they have made public campaign financing programs really less appealing to candidates, and they've taken the power away from lawmakers on every level of government to fashion public campaign financing programs that best fit the needs of those jurisdictions.
So in a case where a group of wealthy interest groups just pour money into a campaign, what had happened, and this is a law in Arizona that was struck down, that would trigger a public financing mechanism. So they've taken away the trigger, but I take it they haven't completely eviscerated the concept of public funding.
That's right. There's actually a real silver lining here where the court did not touch the concept of public campaign financing. The court's ruling is actually fairly narrow. And as you said, it only says that these so-called trigger or rescue funds, additional public funds that publicly financed candidates get as a result of spending by either a privately financed opponent or an independent expenditure group, that those provisions are unconstitutional. But the court very specifically did not go any further than that and did not say anything about the constitutionality of public campaign financing in general, which since 1976, it has found to serve a number of very important governmental interests.
So what were they thinking there? What was wrong with the idea that suddenly, if because nowadays, thanks to Citizens United and the lack of transparency, their unlimited funds can be spent and there's no attribution to who's behind them. So in dealing with the real world, and in the case of Arizona, somebody could, during an election cycle, could suddenly just start pouring unlimited funds in. And there was this mechanism that sort of tried to level the playing field. But I take it that Justice Roberts, in throwing this out, was contemptuous of the idea of the playing field. He said, we're talking about the law, not sports, because this is the guy, by the way, that made the famous
I'm just an umpire
remark in his confirmation. So what are they thinking? Oh, at least can you try and figure this out?
Sure. Well, I'll say that the irony of this ruling is that now jurisdictions can, in fact, create public financing programs that are more inefficient and just basically give candidates all the money up front, even if they don't really need it. But where did this all start? It started in 2008 when the Supreme Court came out with a decision called Davis versus FEC that was about the Millionaires Amendment that was part of McCain-Feingold. And essentially what that case said is, if I am running against a millionaire who spends over a certain amount of her own funds, then I can raise triple the normal contribution limits. So my contribution limits go from $2,300 to $6,900. And the Roberts Court said, no, that's not okay, because the wealthy self-finance candidate will want to stop spending money if they know that a benefit can come to their opponent. I think that this was ill-reasoned for a number of reasons, but the logic of that has been extended to public campaign financing, where the same logic continues that the privately financed candidate or the independent expenditure group will not want to continue spending money if they know that it will result in a benefit to the privately financed, to the publicly financed candidate. And the idea is, if the privately financed candidate or the independent expenditure group will be disincentivized to continue spending money, then that means that their speech is chilled. And that's an impermissible infringement on the First Amendment. Now, I would argue that giving publicly financed candidates enough money to remain competitive and to respond actually promotes First Amendment rights.
So, but this court doesn't seem to understand any proportionality between the rich and the poor, between the powerful and the powerless, between the politically connected and the politically alienated. I mean, if you've got a ton of money and you're up against some sort of skin of the teeth grassroots movement, you've got major, major corporations behind you, they don't see that as an advantage?
You know, I think this court is so focused on what I view as a misreading of what the First Amendment requires, that what you need for what you actually need to protect electoral processes, to promote the marketplace of ideas, this court thinks is no limitations. And I think what you're pointing out is that simply can't be the case. You can't hear everyone. Who you're going to hear from the most are the people with the most money. And this is one in a series of cases where we're continuing this trend of hearing more from those, both individuals and corporations, who have enough money to speak in what is a scarce marketplace.
Again, I'm speaking with Jessica Levinson, who teaches at Loyola Law School and wrote an amicus brief in the Supreme Court case, which we're discussing now, the Arizona case that was struck down. But what about the people of Arizona and the reason why this law came into place? And this law was adopted by voters, and voters supposedly have rights here, in 1998 after an election scandal in which state legislators were caught on video stuffing campaign cash into gym bags. That's why they had this law. And the Supreme Court saying, you know, to those people who felt they were making a judgment, no, you can't. This is not going to stand. This is somehow infringing on the free speech rights of the people who are stuffing the money into the gym bags.
It's sadly ironic for the reasons that you lay out, that the people of Arizona, the people that the court is purportedly concerned with, have said, we need this to protect the integrity of our campaigns. We need this public campaign financing program. And it was a comprehensive program. And the problem with rulings like this, even though it was narrow and there is a light at the end of the tunnel because of that, it does dismantle part of a comprehensive program. And again, to me, it's a misreading of the First Amendment to say that a law that provides publicly financed candidates with enough money to respond to speech is a law that actually infringes on speech.
Well, Justice Kagan did pick up on this irony that the Supreme Court is overruling the people of Arizona, saying less corruption, more speech, robust campaigns leading to the election of representatives not beholden to the few, but accountable to the many. The people of Arizona might have expected a decent respect for those objectives, she wrote. Today they did not get it. Truly, democracy is not a game. Clearly a dig at the Chief Justice.
I think that's right. I mean, to me, one of the really kind of happy surprises from the ruling today is how forceful Justice Kagan's dissent was. She was at times sarcastic. She was very clear ideologically in her position on this. She seemed to telegraph this in the oral arguments, but I think Justice Kagan very much understands the irony also of this decision, that what the court has said to jurisdictions is you basically no longer have the power to best fashion a public financing system for yourselves. So, but what we will allow you to do is create a more inefficient program. And I think that's both wrong under the First Amendment, and it's overreaching when you think about what the people of Arizona who went through these corruption scandals said that they needed to clean up their political marketplace.
Well, just in closing, Jessica Levinson, I remember at the time when Justice Alito was being confirmed, and I spoke with Cass Sunstein, a law professor who's now, he's always was close to Obama, and now he's basically the guy in the White House who's deciding, you know, how much the White House stands up for the citizen and the consumer in terms of the law. And I remember saying to him, I said, well, isn't it simple? You know, that Alito basically is for the powerful over the powerless, the corporation over the union, the rich over the poor, the politically connected over the politically alienated. I mean, that's what that's how the lines are drawn. And he refused to accept that and went into all of these, you know, convoluted legal arguments about, you know, all of the stuff that they talk about in these confirmation hearings. So I just wish there was some simple, blunt clarity here.
Well, we may start to get that from Justice Kagan. And I think Justice Sotomayor has also shown to be a quite powerful dissenter. And the other thing for listeners, of course, to remember is that this was the barest of majorities. This was a 5-4 decision. So if the composition of the court changes so that there's a liberal justice that replaces a conservative justice, many of these precedents could start going the other way. So we really have to see whether this is the beginning of the end or whether this is merely a blip on the screen of campaign finance reform efforts.
Well, to get another liberal justice, assuming that one of the conservatives retire, would require the liberals in this country for voting for Obama or not sitting on their hands. So we'll wait and see on that. I thank you for joining us, Jessica Levinson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jessica Levinson, who teaches at Loyola Law School. She was formerly Director of Political Reform at the Center for Governmental Studies, and she wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in this case that we were just discussing, where the conservative majority ruled to prohibit public election fundings to match excessive spending by wealthy interests.